You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm joined, of course, by...
Jason Wingrave. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
You're excellent. You're rested. You've had a holiday. You're back into it.
I have that phenomenon that when you've worked really hard on something and you stop and you go and sit on a beach somewhere, that you tend to get a cold. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Somebody had a theory that
your body waits until you can really afford to be sick.
And then it says, you know what? Yeah, no adrenaline going through these veins. Boom. So I am suffering a bit from flu, but I'm glad to be in the studio and actually am incredibly well rested. I had a gorgeous time down the coast. Even though it's April here in Australia, we can swim in the surf and do all sorts of cool things, so it's great.
Fantastic.
And while I was away, guess what? There was some interesting things that happened in the world of Red, which we're now able to talk about.
What happened?
Well, firstly, and I guess we should go straight into the news.
And now, the Red Center News.
Okay, well, mainly there is a couple of bits of news sort of filtering around there, but it all probably more relates to some stuff that's being launched in NAB. So we will tackle more of that when NAB rolls around. So
as we're recording this on the Friday before NAB.
Yep.
So this will be coming out, and next week we'll have the NAB kind of wrap up where we discuss everything that's happened. Now, if you remember from last week, we mentioned that the Red Night is on the Wednesday, which is Australia's Thursday. So I think that'll work out pretty well. A week from now, we'll have the news from that night, and we'll also do everything else that came out in the days that preceded it from NAB.
Yes, so a lot of that news will follow up then. Main news was there's a beta build out, beta build 18. So obviously with all of the beta builds, everyone should know that obviously don't put it on your camera if you've got something critical to do. If you're
Fuck at that.
Yes, Mike, but you're sort of part of the, you know, the bleeding edge. But if you're heading into a three-week shoot up Mount Sinai or something at the top of Annapurna 1, perhaps not load build beta 18 onto your camera before you on the way to the airport. No real amazing revelations, like it suddenly shoots, you know, 3,000 frames a second at 4K, but a lot of bug fixes. Now, I've seen a couple of these issues. Mike, have you experienced any of these things they're fixing?
Well, they talk about the blue screen LCD EFF SIM, which is the camera reboot thing. I've actually said the green screen thing. So what we're going to try and do is see if when we put this in, we can emulate the green screen bug, which is a bug where you go to playback a clip having been shooting 4K, sort of 16:9, and it just plays green, even though the clip is fine.
Yes, that's a lot of things, of those weird issues, that the clip is always fine, but it's just enough to make you shit your pants.
Yeah, now the notes for the build actually talk about eliminating the blue screen bug, so I'm not quite sure if the green screen bug remains or not.
I have seen the blue screen, but that generally a one restart and you're okay, and that sort of seems to go away.
And that the other thing was, you know, there's a couple of things, you know, like spit twice and turn around and hold your hands above your head, one of which was never, you know, power up and power down really quickly.
Right.
And that's been fixed. And the trouble with some of these things is if you miss us telling you or you miss reading about it, then you just keep doing those things because from builds, you know, whatever, it didn't work. And so I always do pay attention to these fine print things because occasionally I discover, oh, I no longer have to count to 20 before I restart the camera. And if you miss that, you keep doing that for the rest of your career until someone says, why are you doing that?
Do you know if you put this build on, can you go back to 17 or not? I don't know.
Can. Okay. It's not a fundamental change like there is for 16.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, the main thing was a bit of a camera stall during boot up. Wouldn't quite boot up. Yes, if you shut the camera off and on again quickly, it would do a bit of a weird thing. I've never seen that one personally.
I haven't been using the HDMI, like consumer HD TV set option, since we got the camera, really. I used it. Remember that you came in that day, we had it, you know, way back in a year or two
back
ago.
Back in the day.
But since then, we've never really done that, because that was really just... but that has been fixed up, that menu lockup on
menu lockup, yeah. So essentially, there's a couple of other little additional operational changes, but they just seem like Klingon to me when I read them.
So what he's talking about is things to do with time-lapse and the GPI and how the interval is set for doing things like modified time lapse and stuff, as well as some audio settings in terms of line input and levels. And the details of those are, of course, on the Red site. But you're absolutely right. For most users, most of those points, unless you're
tiny things
on audio and stuff, aren't huge points.
Yeah, again, links to all of the stuff in the show notes. That is essentially it for the news. As I say, plenty more. There's going to be plenty more. Probably, I guess, next episode, Mike, when the NAB stuff starts to roll out. I'm sure it's going to be a big year for third party and for Red itself. We would definitely have had some news from then.
Now, we're going to get into our workflow part two. But before we do that, I want to thank everyone that sent in comments on last week. Apparently, you didn't hate it. It didn't suck. And so in a minute, what we're going to do is do an in-depth look, and I'm going to be able to use now the case study of Red Dwarf, because, Jace, I was given the opportunity with Red Dwarf. You might sort of, in conversation, say to somebody like I have, you know, if you had a perfect world and somebody said you could do it any which way you wanted to, what would you do? And I actually had that on Red Dwarf. I actually had the director, the DOP, and everybody say, in a perfect world, how would you like to set this up? So when I come to this week's case study, as it were, workflow discussion, rather than just tell you theoretically what the buttons are that you should, you know, set your camera to and stuff, we're actually going to sit down with Dean, who was the DIT from Love Productions on Dwarf, and Dean and I are going to go through all of the settings that we set to on the camera, because, you know, it was a perfect world where we had, you know, no sensible limitations. I mean, obviously, every project has things that, you know, bend it a bit one way or another. For example, we wanted to do an Avid workflow, but it was, you know, a really good workflow that worked. And so we're going to tell you how we set it up, how we ran it, even how the DOP rated the camera and what we did and all that kind of stuff. In because I know you guys, especially you, Jace, wanted, you know, an actual, you know, tick
press
the box
this
kind
button,
of,
yeah. Click this box thing. I mean, obviously, you do this for a living. Work out what the best way to do it, so others can learn from your mistakes and your trial and error. Being given this, you know, open brief, how do you want to play it? You must have still then had to sit down, oh, my God, okay, in an ideal world, how the hell do we do this? Or did you just go, yeah, I know?
A little. I guess a lot of things, you know, we'd been arguing the case for. So, for example, shooting daylight on green screen with, you know, 50 IRE, something we've been arguing that this is the way to go for a while. So that was a no-brainer. Other things was a matter of saying, okay, I think I mentioned this last week, but one of the catch-22s was, well, if we tried editing this Final Cut using the Red proxies, we'd have needed 10 terabytes of online storage just for the offline editor to have the proxies referencing the original source files.
Right.
And even though he wasn't using the original R3Ds, he'd have to have them in the same folder, and he would have to have vast amounts of storage. So right out of the gate, we were ruling out the possibility of being able to edit with the proxies. As opposed to if you were doing, say, a commercial, like you may want to just edit in Final Cut. Now, next week, we will actually do the Final Cut Avid stuff, not the Red-specific workflow that we used on Dwarf, but just, you know, what you can do, because obviously we did have the constraint, if you call it that, of having a very large production shooting a lot of footage.
Okay.
And then the following week we'll do, of course, in the fourth final week, we'll do, you know, things that use the SDK and now run and read native R3D flows. But all of this, Jace, is just a taste of what you get over at FXPhD, if I can give
Indeed.
A plug.
Please
because
do.
This
you don't
is,
plug very often, so go
this,
ahead.
Well, it's just that, you know, people are saying they find this really, really valuable. But, you know, me discussing this for 10 or 15 minutes in Red Center, I'm glad you guys love this to death. But, of course, we discuss this in real depth at FXPhD, where we show pictures, show you examples, you know.
Yeah, which was the whole reason for doing, well, part of the reason for doing the project was that you know, that you can learn and share.
Yeah, and so in a completely separate interview on set, Dean and I went through the camera, you know, literally standing there with the camera during one of the lunch breaks. That, the audio that you can hear today is not that. That is a separate thing. This is just me talking to Dean on the phone last week and just running through the setup for Red Center. But, yeah, so if you want to get the really in-depth stuff and see exactly what's going on and, you know, sample clips and all that kind of stuff, then fxphd.com. But I also, as I started out by saying, Jace, we had to thank people that were Twittering and emailing us, and we got a bunch of questions. We don't normally do this, but I think before we even get to Dean's stuff, we should answer questions from last week's episode 30, the birthday edition, where they had some really good points thrown up to us on the Twitters and on the tubes.
Yeah. Well, also, first of all, thank you so much for everyone who did, first birthday thanks and congrats to Red Centre itself. Lots of lovely comments via Twitter and email, so we really appreciate that.
Stu even blogged.
Thank you. Yep, Stu on prolost.com blogged about it, and a thank you blog entry from him. But yes, plenty of others from the Twitter sphere and email friends and from fans of the show, so I really appreciate it. But also, yes, you set the cat amongst the pigeons somewhat with your extremely in-depth episode last time, and obviously there was a lot of feedback and some questions from there.
So let me cover some of that before we get going, because I think it's important. Paul Roskes, who's a good mate of ours, exceptionally good flame artist in Northern America, said that he listens to the podcast, and he was discussing the fact that I was struggling deliberately with the term log and Lin, where Lin referred to, in fact, a video gamma curve. And this is absolutely true. And he pointed out that Stu, on his ProLost blog, as long ago as 2005, suggested that people like me refer to that as video gamma, or vid for short. And then we actually get into the habit of saying log, lin, and video, or log, lin, and vid, when referring to those curves, to try and remove the confusion that comes from people saying, you say, for example, it's not log, so it must be lin, but in fact you don't mean actually linear, you mean a 2.2 gamma, and that isn't linear. So, of course, it's true. I didn't use Stu's suggestion of using the word vid for short, not because I disagree with Stu, just because I haven't found that to be the case in the real world when you're out talking to people. A lot of people still don't use that vid term, and they still use the term linear when they mean vid. But yes, if we could as a community get into the habit of following Stu's suggestion and actually calling vid, linear vid, then we'd be a lot better off. And thank you, Paul, for that suggestion. And quite frankly, guys, I mean, you know, one of the things I struggle with a little bit when doing these podcasts is I'm trying not to just use the technical correct term and then have you walk into a post house and then just look at you like you've got two heads, because, you know, it isn't how everybody else discusses things. Another one, before we get too further into the technical stuff, Scott Matthews, who's a member of the Armed Services, is
Staff Sergeant Scott Matthews.
Yes, is a regular listener to the show. And Jace, we were really pleased to get an email from him during the week, weren't we?
Yeah, look, fantastic. Thank you, Scott. I haven't got that email in front of you. Actually, you got that?
He's being deployed back overseas again, and within the next week or so. So we hope he gets this message from us that we thank him and all the members of the armed services in the various nations that are contributing to the efforts overseas. And, of course, we want him and the rest of his team to be safe. And he actually took a Red camera into a war zone earlier on. And, Jace, you...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what ep number it was, but yes, I had one of our favourite or well-loved Red Room interviews with Scott about shooting on the front line and taking a Red, which is a Red with a massive 6-to-1 lens.
Shot. And I just loved the footage.
It was really, really awesome footage. It was really amazing. It suddenly took essentially doco material and made it look filmic just by the sheer fact of shooting it from a Red one, which is footage versus what they would have probably been shooting on EX3s or something.
And he's with the 129th, right? I think he is.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so obviously enormous debt of gratitude to him and everyone involved in those conflicts. And, you know, we make no comment on the political realities of why someone goes in, but I just thank the Lord that it's not me that has to go into those zones, and especially these guys that are covering the conflict and reporting back. And, as always, to any of the members of the armed services that are listening in any of the key countries, debt of gratitude to you guys for the work that you do. Getting back to the technical stuff, we also got a really interesting podcast note Remember I was talking, Jace, about the fact that the print world tends to think about setups but doesn't discuss how to get your printer to work.
There is no real standard across the sort of printers.
True. In fact, there is, and I had forgotten about it, though I didn't know it to exist. There is a print standard for trying to get a very standard problem out of your printers. A standard print out of your printers. So I remember if I was discussing this last week, I was saying that why does this problem seem to be an irksome thing that's happening to, red footage and doesn't seem to happen in when you open up Photoshop and stuff. And the reason that I gave was that, yes, there are issues to dealing with getting stuff from RAW into a sensible color space, but there isn't a second step going to the printer. Well, there is. It's an ICC profile. And this is a system that was set up a while ago, actually, for trying to standardize to get profiles for the printers to try and get a more standard system happening for printers. Now, the problem is that many cheap printers and many, systems don't use this kind of calibration and setup.
Right.
It's not like video where it's completely standard.
Right, okay, yeah. I mean, as we say, there was a lot of every single printer company has a completely different way of, a way of laying out the way their inks work with a different way of getting it onto the paper, and even just changing paper stocks can have a completely different, result. So ICC?
ICC profiles, yeah. So if you are using a more established, higher-end printer, and certainly if you're working in the print media, you'll be familiar with ICC profiles, and ICC profiles are exactly what we're talking about when we say the second stage of doing a an output having a standardized color space and effectively a LUT. Mm-hmm. But yes, thank you for Chris, who pointed out that I'd not mentioned ICC. And then we got some comments about my assertions about 10-bit Cineon log files being equivalent to, say, 12-bit linear. And this is something that I've had numerous discussions over the years with. The theory that was proposed by David Newman, thank you, was that a 10-bit Cineon file is equivalent to a 14-bit linear in the shadows. In other words, a log file that's 10-bit is producing something very equivalent to 14-bit linear in the shadows. And that may be true. The fact of the matter is that I tend to say that it's equivalent to 12-bit. Whether it's true to 14-bit in the shadows or not, I don't think really matters. We're actually now kind of getting down to what I consider splitting hairs. And to really split hairs, you are not... I mean, David is right in that, you would get great shadow results, so I'm not disputing that. But if you were to go to the point of arguing and splitting hairs, then point blank, 10-bit is 10-bit, right? It doesn't have the number latitude that 14-bit linear has, because 10 bits is a heck of a lot less data than 14-bit. And doesn't matter how much you try and scrunch it 14 bits into 10, you are losing information.
Yeah.
So my point was to say that pretty much these are equivalencies. And once you start getting into equivalencies, you start getting into this argument about, well, is it fully capturing the range? And the answers tend to be, for you and I, Jace, yeah. And for somebody who really, sets up with test equipment, no. But the bottom line is that a 10-bit log file certainly isn't better in any way, shape or form than 12-bit linear, or and certainly doesn't produce any superior post-pipeline when taking 12-bit linear information and turning it into a log file. And I guess that was my point.
So, I mean, say a 2K DI would have a bit rate.
Yeah,
so as in that would normal, be 10-bit or...
Yeah, 10-bit log. And so...
Right, so anything above that, if you're going to, this is that's essentially like the benchmark of what is the average, that's what you're going to end up with. That's the most you can probably, in the average, usage, end up with.
I mean, we are now past the zone of caring about whether or not you would pick it up on a test chart. I mean, or rather, I should say, we're past the zone that you as a director is going to say, hang on, my film doesn't look very good. Oh, my God, you guys aren't using a 10-bit log file path instead of using a 14-bit linear, are you?
I told you.
I've told you twice. Yeah, no, not like that at all. Like, honestly, we're talking about if the DOP doesn't light it very well, then all of this is just a completely moot point and forget about it and don't even,
yeah.
If you were to have, pushed it a stop or two in the grade, I mean, all of these things, completely... override this technical discussion. All I was trying to say is, yes, it's sort of equivalent, but it's certainly not better. And this was my key point. People seem to think that log is better than lin, and it isn't. It's just equivalent in many cases, and certainly no better. and is in fact technically a reduction in data. You know what? Anytime you do anything with an image, I mean virtually anything, you are losing data. If you say, oh, let's crush the blacks, I mean, crushing the blacks is throwing away detail in the blacks and losing data. Now, it may look cool on screen, and I'd be the first to crush the blacks because I like cool-looking images.
Yeah, but if you're throwing it away for a reason, and that's okay. If that's the results, is the results.
It's the results of telling the story. So
it's fine. Whatever gets you there.
And then some of David's other points are, you know, basically going on about the compression stuff. And again, David, I think that you're correct with your assertions about really good 10 and 12 bit compression and noise stuff. But I would say that that I'm trying to restrain myself from Red Center being uber geeky, which of course is something we will happily do over an FX PhD, because Jason, you know, gets a large thing and hits me over the head with it when we drift off, because we are principally filmmakers.
That's why it's not a video podcast.
I don't disagree with your points, David, but I was trying to kind of make my own point, as I said. And then the last one comes from Ian. And so Ian liked our podcast, which was, you know, jolly nice of him.
An Australian.
And an Australian, thank you.
RawDigital.com.
David was Ian was arguing that we shoot 4K for depth of field. Now, I should just be really clear about this. It's actually an interesting use of the term, but here's what's happening. Because you have the sensor being the right size for the lens, you get a depth of field characteristic that's the same as 35mm.
Yeah.
Okay, now, if you were to shoot 2K on the 4K sensor by cropping in, you don't change the depth of field. If you think about that for a second, you change the field of view, but you don't actually change the way the middle bit of light is in focus or out of focus when it hits the middle of the sensor.
Yes, which then therefore then changes your depth of field because you need to change lenses to get the same shot.
True, but it's the second part of that statement that is the key part, as you said. If you want the same field of view, you'll swap lenses, change your camera position, do whatever you're going to do,
and that depth of field does not change. Exactly,
will affect the depth of field.
Yes, sensor crop doesn't change depth of field.
And I'm totally there on agreeing that the filmic nature of what you get out of a RED camera is gorgeous because of the depth of field. In fact, the two things that I love the most about the RED are that we put on PL mount lenses, and that the sensor is big enough so that we get the filmic characteristics of what's happening. That's more important to me than the 4K. If you were getting all
Absolutely.
Of that and 2K somehow, I'd probably still be in love with the camera. The 4K-ness of it is really a slight misnomer, because it's just that the sensor itself is big enough to have those optical characteristics. Now, in his case, he says that they use the 4K pretty much as a pipeline, and they only occasionally frame out a boom mic or something. I'm just going to say that on Red Dwarf, we did a lot of 4K reframings. In some cases, we did it creatively. That's a scene where Lister is, where Rimmer is talking to Katerina. And Katerina is giving a very long monologue that marginalizes Rimmer's character. Now, it doesn't matter if you don't know who these people are, you haven't watched the show. You can understand what I'm saying when you talk about, just in terms of filmic terms, that if a character, it's a comedy, is a two-shot from the side and one of the characters being marginalized, it became very funny when in post we crept in on that shot from 4K down to closer to 2K, moving him to the edge of frame to the point that he was actually out of shot. And that move in post was without quality loss, and it was very funny because his character was creeping out of frame as his character in the story was creeping out of relevance to what was going on.
Yeah.
And it was great to be able to do that, and the director loved it, and there you go.
Absolutely. But you shot 4K the whole way through anyway,
apart
just from a depth of field.
The stunt sequences we were shooting, 2K,
because
we were over frames.
Yeah.
And he also mentions that I didn't mention log and transfer method, which is true. That's coming up in an upcoming app, like next week. Though log and transfer, as I've told Jason on several occasions, has issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I will therefore, if it's okay with you, Ian, discuss your points about colour and stuff next time. Let's see. Anything else? I think we're pretty cool.
Yep, I think so. Yep. So, I mean, what before you headed into the interview and prefacing that, maybe for those who haven't seen the show and or just as a quick backstory, because obviously up until now and or last week, we haven't really been able to sort of talk about the show, essentially what it was, how many, you know, what the sort of basic setup, how many cameras,
sure.
and the sort of format of the thing, I guess.
So Red Dwarf was a comedy on the BBC Two channel in the UK, and at its height when it went off the air about 10 years ago, it was pulling like 6 or 8 million viewers a night. I think it was 8, which is a huge number, especially in today's standards, but back then it was still really great numbers. And the show started as basically a sitcom in space. Now, some people loved it because it was kind of hokey, but I loved it because it was funny. And because it was really well written and because I liked the premise. The thing is, though, that the show had limited ability to do vast visual effects and stuff because 10 years ago it was really expensive. So when they came to do a special, like a kind of a reunion special, in fact a mini-series that was going to be... They quite often do this when, you know, the show will come back and you'll do effectively a telemovie or a, you know, short mini-series.
It's an anniversary thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Then they decided that they wanted to make it look as filmic as possible, and they were able to now address a number of the production issues that they couldn't address when the first production was done. And of course, or not of course, it was a phenomenally great crew and cast. These guys really get on like a house on fire, and so all of the original cast members came back. And I've got to tell you, many of the department heads were people that had worked on the show 10 years ago and were maybe less senior, that were now coming back to the show. Probably wouldn't normally do a TV show like this, but for old time's sake, because they just loved working with the production company and with the actors. And the art department guys and costumes in particular were all very senior heads of department. And they all did it for, I guess, less than their normal rate, just because they loved the show and you know, they'd got their start in the thing. And so I was lucky enough to know the director, and in fact, partly, I guess, because of this very podcast, Jace, when the director and writer, Doug Naylor, was asking around for, you know, who knows about the Red Camera, our name kept on coming up. And Doug was like, well, I know Mike. So he gave me a call, and I was going to initially consult on the Red workflow, and then, in fact, became the visual effects supervisor.
Oh, you just come over.
And, sorry?
Why don't you just come over?
Yeah, I became the visual effects supervisor, and then I actually became the second unit director. Now, we're not going to talk about directing or VFX on this show, though that's all, again, covered over in PhD. What we are going to talk about is the Red workflow, where I was given this kind of incredibly blank piece of paper of people saying, Doug in particular is very forward-looking, very technologically savvy, and felt that he was going to get a cinematic effect that he wanted from the Red cameras, but with a very short time scale, literally about 3 to 4 weeks in post. He had a lot of effects to be done, a lot of post work to be done. Figured he was going to get it from the Red camera where he wasn't going to get it from anything else. So he was right. I mean, we put together a team and terrific, terrific group of people that worked on the project. I mean, just magnificent. Andy Martin was the DOP, and Andy hadn't shot with the Red before, but Andy was a good DOP, and so as we've often heard me say, if you want to shoot a really good production, get a good DOP, something that can light. And Andy
get on with it.
Did some tests. We also had Dean, who's a regular listener to this show, as the DIT from Love. And Dean got together. I wasn't there for the initial testing with Andy in the UK, though I had given lots of instructions to Doug by this stage as to how to approach it and what to do. And they did some testing, which looked great. They tested low light and a few things. And from there, it was agreed that we'd go with the Red camera. Now, the Red camera was post-build 16 changes, and this was all happening, I guess, around the end of last year. So that's give you sort of a time frame. We decided to commit to shooting with the Red. We committed to shooting for an HD finish because we knew it was never going to go to cinema. It was only going to go to TV and Blu-ray. And that's, I guess, the basic backstory. The show went out over Easter, so we're recording this right after Easter, and it had 2.2 million on the opening night. To give you an idea, that's 3 times the largest audience that the channel that went out on had ever seen.
Hmm.
It beat what was on BBC Two, the channel that used to be on that night, and it beat you know, many other channels, and was one of the largest digital channel productions that has ever gone out. I think like the fourth highest rating ever of that style. So huge success. Pretty much been well received by all the fans and the critics and stuff. But quite frankly, if you start getting ratings through the roof like that, you don't really care what the critics say.
Yeah, exactly.
I loved working on it. It was just huge highlight. But it was a gift. It was a gift to work on it with a production that was so open to everything from audio right through, just saying, how are we going to do the best job we can on this? And we just put together our dream team scenario. So I thought, Jace, that it would be a good way to discuss exactly how you might want to set up the Red to show exactly what we did. When our asses were on the line, we had to deliver. We had a very short amount of time, so there was no chance of being able to sustain screw-ups or vast, you know, buggers in post. We didn't have money to burn. And you know what? It worked.
You had the added joy of multiple cameras.
Oh, yeah. We had multiple Reds. I think at the height we had three or four. We were shooting everything from slow motion. We shot, and I'll probably discuss this at some other date, but with the, you know, the lens baby on still cameras? Well, we had a PL mount lens baby on the front at one stage. We had anamorphic lenses on there.
I saw some of the anamorphic stuff, actually,
That was one of the things I got to direct second unit. I was literally given a scene and
I noticed it because I remember you talking about it before and I thought, oh, that must be the anamorphic stuff. It's not. Obviously, it hasn't gone to air here in Australia or probably anywhere else outside UK, but legal or not, there is some high-quality stuff on YouTube.
Yes, and I have my copy here.
There was, at least like a few days ago, some high-quality stuff on YouTube. Not the full episodes, but at least something to give a taste of what's probably going to come to your world soon.
And a lot of green screen. So, you know, if you're shooting visual effects, you're shooting on a tight budget but shooting a big sensible production, shooting where you can't afford to go wrong and you're going to be shooting a lot of material and you certainly can't, you know, manually get around a lot of problems, this is what I would recommend. So I'm going to pick it up from Dean from Love Productions, whose website, by the way, is lovefilmproductions.com. It'll be in the show notes. Dean's a great guy. And, in fact, when I was doing some of the second unit stuff, he came over with the terrific crew that we had and actually gave me some help because we hadn't intended to shoot two units as much as we did. So to say that he was just the DIT, I think is maybe doing him a slight disservice. I think he was certainly I found him to be an incredibly great collaborator, as I know Andy Martin and the other guys did.
Fantastic.
Dean, thanks for joining us. My friend, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you, Mike, for letting me on the show.
That's all right. So as we're speaking, Dwarf is about to go to air in the UK, though as everyone's listening to this, it has in fact gone to air, so hopefully it went to air well. I wanted to ask you about the project and have a bit of a chat about it, because I think people are interested in some of the decisions we made. And I wanted to start by discussing the choice of how you recommended the cameras be set up in terms of colour space and stuff. Do you want to tell me how the Reds were set up?
Well, both of the Reds were set up in Red Space, and we just kept them that way. I think the main reason for doing that, though, is so that the images on the monitors are basically creating an image that most people on set feel comfortable with, so you don't have to explain, oh, this is going to look different later. So I think that was our main call, was sticking with Red Space, really.
So I think one of the things that people don't fully understand is what's going on with Rec 709 and with the camera RGB and with the Red Space. And basically, the Red Space is giving you a more contrasty kind of look on the feed straight out of the camera. So as a consequence, I think they both have sort of similar dynamic range, but there's more actual kind of contrast in the Red Space look, neither clip and neither like crush the blacks, but it does tend to make it look a bit more like what you'd expect to see, and less a bit washed out. I think that washed out thing can be quite off-putting on set.
I think it's very hard. I mean, I think when it's washed up as well, as a job to judge colour, and particularly if art department are looking on the screens as well, it's very hard for them. So I think that Red Space overall gives an image which I think people feel comfortable with. And I also feel it's a really great way, if you're working with the cameras first time, for people to see the images, because they instantly start to get excited, and the nervousness that people often have when changing a camera tends to be put to one side the minute they start to see pretty pictures.
Now, do you often put the camera into camera RGB or RAW to look at sort of determining whether the highlights have been clipped or anything? I mean, do you yourself tend to run the camera in Red Space or...?
Yeah, I tend to run it in Redspace myself because of the fact that I'm a real big fan of the histogram. And to be honest with you, the one thing that I use the most probably is false colour. And I absolutely love that. It gives me more idea than anything else of what's going on with the image. So to be able to just have that on one of the user buttons is just fantastic. And tend to do the exposure off that. And to be perfectly honest, find that I get the best results.
Now, the thing is, if I was looking at a green screen, as we had a lot of green screen on Dwarf, and I was to jump between Redspace and, say, I don't know, Rec. 709, actually the Redspace is going to read the green screen at a higher IRE. So if I had 50 IRE on, say, Redspace, then it wouldn't be reading quite 50 when I was in Rec. 709. Now, in fact, the same information is being stored on the sensor, but I generally find that Redspace guides us to kind of a more... reasonable highlight protection because it is a bit punchier and so we're a little bit more conservative. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really good thing as well because it means that when you get to the grade that you probably got a little, you can go a little bit further and it kind of gives you a safety area. I think if you, I've often seen people kind of like judge images off RAW or even Rec. 709. And then when you get to the grade, for whatever decision to make an effect shot easier or whatever it is, they've decided to grade it slightly differently to how they exposed it on the day. And then, therefore, it's kind of restricted them a little bit because there's no space in the highlights to go any further.
So when you were on set, we had the cameras set up in Redspace and you would take the files when they came off the camera. And I will come back to the rest of the settings on the camera. And you'd pop them up on your screen. And what you were showing on your screen at the DIT station looked pretty much as the same as what we were seeing on the split monitors. Wasn't that correct?
Yes. Yeah, everything was displayed in Redspace. What would normally happen is that the files would come in off the drives. I mean, we had an 8-core Mac there at all times and 16 terabyte fiber RAID due to the amount of storage that we needed. I will probably come back to that later. But then the files would be brought across. I'd probably pull over Andy or Doug if we had time and just go through the rushes in Red Cine. And then if everyone was kind of happy with them, we may go across to Red Alert, make a few adjustments to the proxies, create some RSXs so we could create the offline rushes essentially. So again, when the footage was looked at in the offline, it was kind of closer or close as we could get it to how the original would end up in the end.
So I guess the question that people are really interested in is, if you wanted to pull a RED out of the box and you have it set up for the most standard kind of safest, most sensible way to run, assuming that you're shooting daylight, what would you set the camera to? So let's just go through that. Like if I was pulling out a camera, we're on Dwarf, we're going to shoot, let's just work through what would be the kind of standard setting that would be the no surprises kind of setting. And in our case, we were shooting effectively double HD, weren't we?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a really great call, but I mean, it doesn't make a lot of difference, I think, from how you shoot it. I just think it makes things a little bit easier in post and saves you a bit on rendering time.
Yeah, in our case, it made sense so that nobody got used to a 2x1, you know, cropping or framing.
Yes.
Only to discover later that they were going to lose something when it went to HD, because we obviously had a TV finish.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that probably the best thing to do is, you know, set the camera for 320 ISO, and I think always shoot it at 320 ISO, particularly if you're in a daylight situation, because that seems to give you the maximum dynamic range, and it's definitely the camera's sweet spot.
Though we were saying on set, weren't we, that we were sort of saying in a polite way that Andy should treat the camera a bit like 200 daylight stock, because that would give him the kind of best benchmark going in of what to expect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I often wonder why this is, but I mean, I think that, you know, it's somewhere between 200 and 160 is how the camera seems to react. And I don't know why this is a red question, but why the camera is rated at 320 when it seems to be much more similar to 200 and 160. The only thing that went through my mind is if, because of the fact that when you do, and this is one thing that no one really should do, I don't think, but when you do put it to a 360 degree shutter, then you get the same kind of light levels as you would shoot in 320, because obviously a film camera can't open up to that kind of shutter angle.
Well, that's a good point, isn't it? Because that was one of the other things we absolutely insisted on, which was 180-degree shutter. So we had 320, 180-degree shutter. We were shooting daylight. In our case, as I said, we set it 16:9 aspect ratio. We had it set in Redspace. But we really tried to never, if we're going to vary any of those things, the last one we tried to vary is that 180 degree shutter.
And I think that's an absolute right move. I mean, I think the day we all got our Reds and we all ran around excited, we all shot 360 degree shutter and went, isn't it amazing how well it works in low light? And then the minute we went into a grade and saw it on a proper monitor, you just went, that looks like video.
Yep.
And so the first thing, it's kind of like the golden rule, I think, is try and keep that shutter at 180 degrees. Or if you're looking at it in sort of photographic shutter mode, then whatever frame rate you're at, double it for the shutter. E.g. if you're shooting 25 frames, then shoot 150, 30 frames, then shoot 160, 100 frames, try and shoot 200.
In fact, I think I think the only time we got pushed on that was, if I remember, when we were on set on Coronation Street inside the studio. There was one point that we were going to put on a less than fast lens, and that was about the only time I think we ever got into a discussion where we were starting to work how we could juggle ISO, frame rate, speed and stuff to not hit that 180 degrees.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there was two things as well in there. I mean, although it was obviously the sets were already pretty much pre-lit, so there wasn't a lot of space to do many other things. And also, because we were working with tungsten, we had the ATB filters in, which were costing us a good stop and a half.
Yeah.
And I think the core that we went for in the end was 500 ISO, and I'm absolutely sure it was the right core.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you could pick that 500 ISO. I actually did end up doing effects on that stuff because, if you remember, Danny or Kat's character was holding up what was effectively an origami piece, and it was the wrong one on the day that we shot in Coronation Street, just for art department reasons. And so I had to digitally replace that. And so I looked at that footage up close and personal, and 500 was fine. I mean, there was just no question in my mind that that footage looked fine, and I was looking at it obviously on a God monitor at my end.
Good. And how did it track? Were you okay tracking it?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. No, there was no problem with tracking. In fact, that's interestingly something that I was commenting about with the knowing. I mean, those guys managed to track those shots where the plane crashed. And we spoke to Andrew Jackson over at Animal Logic, and they tracked what I consider to be vastly harder stuff than we had to track. So, yeah, no, I had
that
no stuff, problem.
I mean, that shot is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's fantastic. Massive respect goes out to those guys.
Oh, totally. I think I wasn't aware of any other. We had like a couple of bugs on the cameras. I think the only bug that really annoyed us at all, though it caused us no long-term damage, was a playback problem when we were trying to play back from the camera in that 16:9 mode. But that was literally that when you hit the playback, it went to a green screen, though the files themselves were fine. And I don't think we ever found a proper good workaround for that, did we?
No. I mean, it's the green screen of death, as it's been nicknamed. And, you know, it's been an ongoing thing, I think, since about build 16. And I kind of know why it does it. I mean, it's fine because of the fact what we'd done is we'd laid one audio track into the camera as a guide track, so we had kind of synced rushes off the microphone. And what that had done is I just basically, whenever you have an audio track and video at 36, then you seem to get this playback error. And I'm sure it's something to do with data rate coming back up through the cable that maybe the camera's just pushing.
But if it's in the 16:9 aspect ratio, I don't think I've seen that in the 2:1 aspect ratio, have you?
I've not seen it in the 2:1 aspect ratio, and I've also not seen it if you shoot RC28. It seems to be fine.
I think we shot 36 all the time, didn't we? The higher data rate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, so let's just also discuss some of the other things on the camera, because it's kind of interesting. We were talking about what we saw on the video split being the same as what we were seeing over at your DIT station, but we should point out that we were using some pretty cool wireless HD transmitters on set, which is the first time I'd use those. Do you want to tell us about those?
Yeah, they're fantastic. IDX brought them out, I think, about a couple of months ago, and they're absolutely brilliant. Basically, it's just HD SDI into the back of a transmitter, and it's wireless, and it's fantastic. In fact, the other day I did a commercial where we put a Red camera on a waltzer, and we put one of these on. It was absolutely rock solid. I mean, you could have broadcast off it. And they're fantastic. They just go on the back of the battery, and then you just run a cable up to it, and that's it. Because it goes in between the battery and the battery mount, it automatically powers. It's a very neat solution, actually.
Yeah.
Great for handheld.
And you actually had a couple of other additions to the camera, didn't you? But before we get to those, I want to just also finish out that audio thing. We also were syncing the cameras because audio was separately recording, obviously, as they would, at the audio desk, and then we had a feed from that feeding over to the Red, so that, as you say, we had effectively synced rushes. And so we were running timecode. Just tell us about the timecode syncing between all the cameras and the audio.
In fact, the cameras become quite a beast in the end because there's quite a lot of little bits on them, and I think that's probably where the Red ends up most of the time on jobs by now. But essentially what we had on the camera was a locket box, which is an Arton locket box, which was radio transmitted from the sound mixer, a time code to the camera. So therefore, both the cameras were kept in sync by the locket box. We also had a small radio mic, which was being sent a mixed track from the sound mixer and just put it on the one single channel, so the rushes were synced. So whenever we did playback or we played back on the DIT station for Doug, then the rushes were synced. It also helped the guys at post because they knew when their rushes were synced because they could just line it up with the original audio, even though there was a clapperboard to help them anyway. And also we had, well, basically those were the ways that we synced the camera. And then we also had other things on the camera, like down converters as and when needed, if we were using cranes and stuff. We also had on the camera sometimes the Preston. And it ends up quite a lot of stuff actually in the end. So one of the most useful things I think I bought, which was just absolutely no money, was a small D-tap, multi-point D-tap, which a friend of mine, Phil Asprey at DP, said this would be really useful. And we put it on the back of the camera, and that's been very useful because all of those accessories can just run off that. And we also, most of the time, I run the batteries on a V-Lock battery hot swap system so that we have two batteries on there. That's really useful when we're running these extras, such as the Preston, the locket box, etc., because it increases the amount of power going through to the camera. And it means that Preston tends to pull quite a bit of power. So I definitely think it's safer to double up the power that way. And also what I think with the double up battery swap is it's great to be able to just swap the batteries and not have that minute of initializing, because that 1 minute of initializing, although it's only a minute, is always the most important minute at the worst time when it happens.
No, I must admit, it's better than now. You get a picture up while it's still coming up. Like it's incredibly helpful getting that picture earlier rather than just sitting there waiting for 2 minutes.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was kind of like when that happened in Red World, that was revolution to me. It made such a big difference.
So let's discuss the files when they got over to you and how they worked with Avid, because I think that's of interest. So we should point out that we decided to go with Avid because the editor wanted to go with Avid, and that's great. It's a good editor, and we were totally happy to do that. And the only thing that we thought would be useful, and I think it was to run the Avid actually on a Mac. But you had a network system set up so that you could feed the Avid, and also you had an Avid set up software-wise on your machine. So let's just walk through that, shall we?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of confusion with the Red and Avid because we've been working with Avid since day one, partly because I'm a big fan of it too. So it was fantastic. I mean, I think it's a fantastic combination, Red and Avid, once you get it working. And what we were doing essentially was the R3D files would come in. They were thrown on Red rushes, and just because of the fact that it was an offline, we'd do a quarter debayer. I only need a quarter debayer to create Avid DNxD files. Those Avid DNxD files would then you can actually export an Avid log exchange from Red rushes. But I like to use MetaCheater because it allows me to put the tape and camera roll names into other areas rather than just the file names. And the reason I do that is just in case the editor renames the files, it can make things very complicated. So I tried to tell him not to rename the files, but also did that as a safety precaution. Then that Avid log exchange would be brought into the Avid, and the Avid would see a load of files then with media offline, and we would just reconnect the media by batch import. It would just fly in, and we'd do this on the DIT station. And then because we were in Shepherd and Studios, we just ran a Ethernet cable from the studio along the roof all the way to the Avid. And what I would do is just take the media from my machine and just drop it into his machine. Plus in his bins, we had a small folder called Camera Rushes. And I would put the Camera Rushes bins that I'd created into that. So therefore, they would just pop up on his machine the minute he restarted it and he'd see the new rushes. And I would just do that continuously throughout the day so that we were drip feeding in the rushes. And what tended to happen was, and this is something I'm kind of proud of because it worked really well. I mean, we could get the rushes off the camera and in the Avid in an hour, and they were syncing them.
I was going to say, where was the audio being sunk, the actual final audio syncing as opposed to the rough sync from the camera?
Well, what would happen was I'd get the audio over a file or a DVD from the sound recordist, Chris, who used to use a Fostech 605, and that would create an ALE as well. That ALE would be sucked in, and then I'd reconnect to the WAV files that he created. And to be honest with you, I could sync at that end, but actually they did it at the edit end. So Chris, the assistant editor, would just go in, select the files. But I think it was relatively straightforward because of the fact that we'd given them time code, that as long as those audio files and the video files were put in the same folder, hit auto sync, and they were synced. I'm not completely sure it's always that easy, but that was in essence the idea, and it worked really fast. What I loved about it was the days where Doug was able to go in the edit suite and see something just after he shot it and know that he might need to get a couple more shots before we'd even taken the sets down. And I think that was worth its weight in gold.
Well, I think there are two other things that were worth the weight in gold there. One was that because we were shooting a lot of green screen and out of sequence, it was really helpful for the actors occasionally to come over and for you to be able to access back to the Avid setup so you could play something for them so they could see, oh, that's where I was when we're picking this up with this whatever pickup it was. And so I think that's an important point, that you could actually access back the other way.
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, that is... I mean, funny enough, we're doing a feature film at the moment, and we're doing it using exactly the same workflow. But what is a lot of location work. So we're just basically being sent Avid files via a USB wireless dongle, or not wireless, 3G dongle. And we just throw the new bins in, and it accesses the rushes and brings the new edit up on set. So we're able to do that on location wirelessly, which is just brilliant because the director can see the cut, the actors can see the cut, and you can see exactly what's working and what's not working and what you need to get. And it suddenly becomes so much easier. You just don't feel like you're in the dark anymore. And I personally think that this is probably where Red's going to become more and more useful, because of its post-workflow, it just gives you the edge as a storyteller big time.
Yeah, I must admit, the other thing I was really glad we did, though I guess in some respects one might argue wasn't necessary, was we actually did have a clapper. We did actually have slates. We did bother writing. Certainly for my team, it was very useful. We wrote the lens information on those slates. And so even though, you know, theoretically there's metadata in there that's going to able someday to be accessed to record stuff that's iTech, it was tremendously useful. And also as a confidence check, it was just so nice being able to have slates on the front of clips, though slightly different workflow, of course, because we're so used to, you know, buttoning on, getting the slate and buttoning off. We had to make sure we had those slates in the same button on as the performance, otherwise they would get disconnected in post.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to try and explain that concept to people until they see how Red does the files. You know, it doesn't make sense. So I think, you know, you've got to keep that camera running, because just having a clip randomly, although it's the next number in the sequence, it's quite hard for editors and people to get their head around what that's related to. So you've got to get it in the same take. But
I mean, the thing about it is that it's not that hard to do a slate, and it is a tremendous confidence check. And I've got to say that, you know, it's a discipline that we've sort of got used to not doing. But if anything does go wrong, it's terribly reassuring to know that you've got slates to line up on, I think.
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the things that I started encouraging on the last couple of jobs after that one is that we've always got the camera assistant or camera trainee, whoever's doing the clapperboard, to just have a little look at the monitor and make a note of the name of the next R3D file. So put that on the board as well.
Oh, really?
So that we have the 8001, C0, whatever, because it's about, you know, it comes up in the monitor. It's a really easy thing for them to add. And if continuity make a note of that too, then if someone needs to find a file instantly, a month later on a big shoot, they can just name the file and I can get it up instantly. Well, and that is so fast.
The bottom line for us is we had an incredibly short post period, sort of 27, 28 days from end of principal photography. And not, I should say, from the end of all photography, because there was a whole other weekend in there. And we had to get three whole eps out. So having those slates was this ultimate kind of, for me, safety net, that if we got into trouble, we weren't going to be spending a week trying to work out what was what. So probably didn't need it in some respects, did definitely need it. The visual effects team really, really appreciated having it.
I think when you're staring at a monitor at 4 a.m. and you haven't slept for 48 hours, I think everything helps.
It so does, yeah. And you know what? I mean, there is there were occasions where we were trying to line up, you know, an effects takes. I know we're running over to you and saying, could we see what lens was used on this shot? Because we wanted to do something that would be another element for the same shot on green screen. And, you know, you would just call up trying to find that shot, obviously via date and timestamps, and then be able to just look at the slate and yell back, it was, you know, whatever it was. Hey, speaking of lenses, you and I had a bit of fun in one of the sequences, which was, well, a couple of them actually, but we did some second unit stuff where we got to use some perhaps less than obvious lens choices. Do you want to tell us about those?
Yeah, I've got a set of anamorphic Lomos. When the Red camera first turned up, I mentioned Phil Asprey before, he's a DP friend of mine, just said to me, look, this camera is going to look amazing with these lenses on because it's going to take the edge off it and everything that, I mean, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love my Red camera. I love the Red, it's awesome. But everything that we don't like about it, the Lomos tend to take away, they soften the edge and just take away some of that clinicalness. So we got a set of Lomos and they're just fantastic on that camera. It suddenly feels so much more organic. So yeah, I brought them along because, hey, you know, people will see this when Red Dwarf goes out, but there's a lot of what we were doing was trying to look like Blade Runner. And of course, I think the lenses used on Blade Runner were the Panavision C-Series. Now, unfortunately, I will never get to own a set of Panavision C-Series lenses, but the next closest thing are probably the Lomo Anamorphics. So, yeah, we shot a few bits on those, and I just think they're great. The way they flare and the way they work with the Red. There's been great projects that I've seen on Red User where people have used them, and I just think that with the Red, at the moment, wherever I get the opportunity, I want to get the Lomos out and just shoot them on Red because I think they look fantastic. And there's also something about the fact that the Red, you know, the Red, for instance, doesn't have the dynamic range of film, but does have the dynamic range of probably what film had in the 80s. So therefore, when you use the combination of these lenses with that camera, it really works.
I mean, those flares we were getting, we were literally shining torches down the lens, and we used some mirrors to try and reflect light down, and we just got those great horizontal flares, some really nice bokeh and defocus stuff. I think it was terrific. And you know what? I mean, it just looks good on screen as well. I mean, I've been able to see that stuff at higher than HD res because it was anamorphic, and it just looks gorgeous. And I think you're right. I'd love to shoot a whole project like that. It'd be just terrific.
I definitely think someone probably is as we speak, and we're going to look at it and go, wow, why did we do that? That's just absolutely brilliant. I mean, the only thing to say when shooting we're shooting with the Lomos is because we were lighting with tungsten, is we had to kiss goodbye to the ATB, and we had to basically bring the ISO up in the camera to say 200 and then tungsten correct. Otherwise, you need to get direct light on the front of those anamorphic lenses to really make the best of the flare and make the best of they react. And often matte boxes when stuff will crop the edge of the flare slight, so it looks a bit odd. So,
well, a whole lot of these matte boxes and flags are there specifically to stop flares, right? So we were doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, no, funny enough, this sounds completely insane, but one of my shades on a matte box got broken the other day, so I've had to replace it. So with the old shade, I've actually put mirrors around it for exactly that, for putting it on with the anamorphic and bouncing light into the lens, which sounds nuts, but the results we're getting at the moment are really cool.
Well, the other thing we managed to put on was the PL mount lens baby, which is, well, it's like a shift and tilt lens. It's really a shift, but not so much tilt, or tilt but not shift, I should say, lens. But that was also fun, you know, mucking around with that. And I must have been, I put an order in to get one. They're not very expensive, those cinema or movie versions of the lens baby, aren't they?
Absolutely fantastic lens, just so good for the money. I mean, I first saw it on the Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and just, what is that? Is that a set of Claremont? Is it? And someone said, no, it's a lens baby. And the minute we found the PL mount one, just ordered it straight away. And it's amazing.
Like,
I think
$450 for a PL mount lens baby. I just can't imagine you not wanting one.
It's so clean as well, because of the fact essentially there's no glass in it, so it's so clean. And it looks lovely. It's very useful as well, because you often get yourself in situations, particularly if you're doing certain types of work, where you have to shoot a frame and there is something in frame which is ugly and you can't do anything about it because it needs to be that frame for whatever reason. throw the lens baby on and just put that bit of the frame out of focus slightly, and it just works. It saved my life on corporate projects no end.
Yeah, well, look, it was tremendous working with you. Thank you so much for all the
thanks,
help
Mike.
You gave on set, and also thanks for talking to us now. I really appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure.
Right, okay, that was fantastic.
I've got to tell you, I hope that you can tell from that interview. I mean, I just loved working with Dean. I loved working with everybody on this production. It was, you know, there's a production that you'll go on that, you know, it's like, who the hell do I have to kill to get off this production?
Yeah.
Imagine the opposite of that. Imagine a production where people are willing to work just astonishingly hard because they just genuinely love it. And, you know, the lead on that, of course, is the director who sort of sets the tone.
Mm.
And, you know, look, your shoots are great as well, but, of course, your shoots don't tend to run for, you know, a month.
No, we just don't have that sort of length of time where everyone just gets into the flow. You don't get into the stride. I mean, the longest sort of commercial I've ever done is probably about sort of 7 or 10 days. And that's really, you know, you're only just starting to get into that whole camaraderie thing that makes, you know, filmmaking one of the last great kind of team sports that there is, really. So, yeah, we never really get to quite hit the stride that no doubt you guys would have.
Yeah, and it was great. And the post-production on it was just awesome. I mean, the team we had working on it. We did 262 shots in 27 days. If you do the maths, we were clocking in around 10 shots a day. Now, of course, we did a lot of pre-production to be able to hit that.
Mm.
But that was a friggin' effort in itself. And, of course, as I keep on saying, we're not covering that here. But we.
So you can imagine, you know, if you scale that up, the amount of fun that you had on that. Imagine how much fun now David Strabinus is having on after 3 years of Avatar.
Absolutely.
Okay,
so
sorry,
look, there is some other news, but if you have questions before we get to the, not so much news, sorry, tech geeky gear stuff, if you have any questions about the Red workflow on Dwarf, please, again, send us emails. We will really try and answer them. And, you know, we just love hearing from you guys. It really makes a big difference
Absolutely.
To us.
Absolutely. It's always red@fxguide.com.
So now, what other geary stuff do we have?
There is a lot of stuff, as I say, going to start pouring out next week, and we will definitely cover that. One of the things which I think I can tackle beforehand is I sort of was in two minds about this sort of product. I wasn't going to feature it because it's just phenomenally expensive, I think. But then when I dug deep into what it actually does, I thought, no, this is actually, if this is your gig, you're going to want this piece of software. Now, essentially what we have is, it's called Qtake HD. Now, this is a development of a piece of software that has been in the market for a little while, but essentially it is the piece of software for doing video split, for doing video village, for recording on set. Now, a lot of people use Final Cut Pro, but this is a very, very different beast, although it does have some interaction with Final Cut
Pro.
When
you say it's phenomenally expensive, how much are we talking about?
Well, the base model, which really sort of will let you just do some simple sort of capture and color effects, is $4,000 US. But then with all of the functions that it can do, which I'll go through about sort of doing some composition and doing DVI outputs, and is like $9,000 US.
But I guess if your job was being a
Absolutely.
Video split guy, $9,000 is, because there are some dedicated packages out there for video split.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't think any, I mean, the trouble is, how many of these are you going to sell, you know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, obviously they've done the math and worked out, look, this is obviously going to be phenomenally intensive to code and to make this piece of software, and they've done the numbers, I guess. Look, I'll go through why I guess this is probably better than probably doing Final Cut Pro. Obviously, it's laid out specifically for this task. There's no delay, obviously, of recording tasks, of recording takes. It's all designed to run on a touchscreen for even quicker operation, you know, like hit that button almost like a big VTR in front of you. To look at the window, and again, there's screenshots and things at qtakehd.com, and obviously there's some links on the show notes. But it's laid out a little bit like Final Cut Pro, but obviously what you can do is once you've recorded a take, it immediately switches into like playback mode, where you can then obviously, what you obviously want to do as soon as you've done a take, someone's going to shout playback, and you're going to immediately want to play it back and know which take to play back. Final Cut Pro, obviously, once you've captured something, you're going to have to find that clip in the bin and then, you know, double click on it. This is obviously set up to immediately, as soon as the shot's captured, to play it back. Now, you'll probably have to explain this a little bit of Klingon for me, Mike, but it performs real-time reverse pull-down for Red 1, because obviously part of the reason I'm mentioning for this, that there is a couple of specific red functions on it. Obviously, it's catering for a lot of cameras, but this is a couple of the red specific. Does that make sense to you?
None whatsoever. Unless they're putting in pull down.
QTake HD is the only video assist software capable of recording only valid frames from Red One camera SDI output. This way, you can capture real 720p 24, just like Red Cam.
Yeah. So I'm okay. So what they're saying is, because of course this is all predicated on the assumption that you're taking the video feed from the side
from
of
the SDI
camera, and if you are wanting to, yeah, okay, because I guess this. It's an interesting question, isn't it? This is, because it's video playback assist, this is all happening off not the R3Ds, as it were, but the video tap from the side.
Yes.
Okay, so they're...
Which is different to what's going down to R3D land?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So
but still good.
Still good, yeah. It's still just different. So what they're trying to do is give you a way of recording from the SDI a more valid representation of what is in actually in the R3Ds as opposed to what's output on the HD output of the camera, so as to allow it to play back on, say, a Panasonic normal, what you'd call studio monitor.
Right, okay.
So that does make sense, actually.
Okay.
I mean, the point about this stuff is that you are, in a sense, throwing this stuff away normally because you're not normally going to want to edit with this.
No.
Because normally you're going to want to say, why would I use the 720p feed when I've got a 4K master?
Yeah.
And even if I didn't use the 4K, I'd probably use the 1920 by 1080. Now,
well,
it is treating
it
1920 by the side, but then it's only on playback, not live during the take.
Well, look, a lot of Video Village stuff seems to run on SD. There's so much of that sort of legacy gear around that, you know, everyone wants to. If you've got an HD camera or, a Vericam or a Red, you're going to want to... Someone's immediately going to be fishing out a down converter to run into all their existing gear. But obviously, if you're recording, if you're finishing HD or you're finishing to 2K or whatever, it's great to... You know, I'm not quite sure what that takes sharp. I mean, obviously, you can play it back from the camera, but it'd be great to have your monitoring and Video Village being capable of being playing back stuff that you can, you know, at least, you know, pick focus. Was it sharp?
Okay, but there's two issues to that, right? If you did play back from the camera, you would get 1920 by 1080, which is a significantly better picture for judging. And secondly, and quite frankly, we weren't happy with SD on our splits.
Is that what you were running?
We did HD. We had wireless,
HD.
Because we just found that if you stick an SD monitor up versus what's coming out of the Red and you show the director, then they'll sit in front of the high-res one.
Yeah, because it's surprising how many people on set will actually, you know, a lot of technical people, you know, first
make up.
First, you know, focus pullers immediately will, you know, if they're not quite sure, particularly if you're running something where no one's got their eye to the finder, a locked-off camera or a Steadicam or something like that. A lot of the time, there'll be this sort of, you know, video jury will hang around going, was it sharp? Did it dip there a little bit? Obviously, those kind of calls are going to be a lot easier to do on high def. So moving on to some of the other reasons why this is a little bit better, I guess, than Final Cut. Quick take selection. It has all the clips are all laid out in like a tree-based view. So it's all thumbnails, and you can rate them as per, you know, the director's favorites. So it's a little bit easier to grab them. Image processing. Now, obviously, this is important because obviously Final Cut Pro, everything you want to do, if you wanted to say you've got a green screen, you want to mat something in, or if you've got a previous take that you want to play back over live vision, it's just impossible to do that kind of stuff without having a video mixer. And a lot of the rigs will have like Final Cut Pro and then a mixer, and you know, so you've got 15 bits of gear, 15 bits of gear, and you've got a trolley that's twice the size of the sound guys, which is really saying something. So with this one, obviously you can do masking and matting and green screening live, so you can play back a take off disc and you can split screen that over something coming live out of the camera. So
okay,
if you've got actors looking at each other and doing timing, it's like, you know, pretend twins or whatever. If you've got to do something where someone's reacting to a take that they recorded, you know, in makeup of playing another character or whatever, then obviously you can do that kind of stuff.
So again, not to pick on QTake HD, which I think is good, but we did the live compositing using Conduit Live,
right?
And Conduit Live allowed us to take a live feed from the HD cameras,
yep,
convert it via an Arjabox into a FireWire feed to my laptop, and then my laptop was getting the feed from the camera, and I have a feed from, say, a matte painting coming from the hard drive, and composite the actor over the background. But much in the way that Shake is a nodal-based compositor, I could take those feeds and crop them, blow them, key them, blow up the background, you know, resize things to make them line up.
Okay. And, which is, you know, fantastic if you're Mike Seymour and you know what you're doing and you can have 50 million things.
Obviously.
So this is all in one. I'm not sticking up for this either, but I'm just saying this is all in one piece of software. And you
well,
know,
let me just say this
is for video split operator
people. It is
people,
really
okay?
important to be able to do that. It is important to be able to do it. We did it, and I would say that it's a selling point of any, you know, video split playback setup that it'd be able to do that.
And you can do apply masking and color correction. So theoretically, you could block out all the extra crap and all the extra. If you're running a camera that's, say, got, you know, just a ground glass and your actual image area is like a third of the frame, you know, inside in a square inside a square inside a square, when you actually want to mat out all the rest of the other junk and also then apply a bit of a color correction.
I did
to
that on Conjure.
Yeah, I know. And you keep going.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, I'm sure. And to do color correction, if you've got sort of a crappy video split image and you want to make it actually look good on the fly, which I'm sure you can do with Conjure. So now this is another one of the Red features, Red Mag synchronization. Synchronize Qtake HD media files to original R3D files located on Red 1 digital mags. Red file names and the metadata is attached to corresponding clips, enabling you to use Qtake HD files as a self-contained movie ready for offline edit. So there's a lot of prep you can do.
So what I'm taking from that is that I basically take down the images live, but then it will substitute in for any sort of rough FCP stuff I kind of export out as an XML.
Right.
The original names, the original files. I'm guessing that's what it's doing. Is that what it's doing? So in other words, it would be like I would mock it up with what I'm getting from the split, but then it's built so that I could then substitute in the actual shots to reference them.
Yeah, I think, yes, exactly. So it's working with stuff it's captured and that is going to, because what you can obviously do is do basic editing, basic one-line sort of non-linear editing with this, and essentially everything you do with your bins and, you know, sort of timelines can all be exported out to Final Cut Pro so that all the bins match up. And so I guess that's sort of...
But there's no metadata feed coming out on the 720p output of the Red 1. So you'd have to manually link that to the files. Hmm. Because also it doesn't even know when it's button on, button off on that feed from the 720.
Well, look, this is... Well, hey, if you work for Qtake HD and or if you're interested in this and you're heading to NAB, which I'm obviously the short part of these announcements, and this is all sort of going to be, you'll be able to go to NAB and look at demos. They're going to have live demos there from what I understand. So, look, hey, if anyone wants to feel like sort of doing a bit of digging a bit deeper on that, or if you actually work for Qtake HD,
email us if there's a cleverer way of Red Mag syncing other than manually reconnecting to the data files.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I guess if this was your gig, this would be a good tool, I'm sure, to make yourself look professional. Half the time, you can actually look like a total dickhead. If you're not playing back when it's requested, or if you've got a fanny around and it takes forever to try and, if someone says, can you take that shot, freeze it, and then mat it? I want to see a side by side with this, or, you know, wipe over the top, and, you know, if you're able to do that kind of stuff. If you can't do that kind of stuff really quickly, then you can look like a doofus real quick. So anyway, it's worth sussing it out. As I say, it is a bit expensive. The base stuff's $4,000 essentially US. And if you want to add all of the nonlinear stuff and the compositing and the green screen and the export, then that's, you're getting up to $8,000 or $9,000. And obviously you will need to have, I think it works with, obviously you'll need some SDI capture cards to get that into your Mac Pro. This is obviously all designed for Mac Pros or MacBook Pros and for Leopard. So,
well, MacBook Pros are a completely different proposition because there you're not going to have any input cards device, so then you have to go through something like the ArcherBox that we used, you know, the cute thing that looked like a shrunk tower.
Yes.
That does the conversion from the HD feed to a FireWire, because, but having said that, being able to do that live compositing on your laptop is pretty friggin' cool.
Yes. Theoretically, the hardware requirements are new MacBook Pros, basically. But I guess the Azure IOHD is what they recommend as the in-out box, which is what you've got, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, they're great boxes. Not particularly cheap, again, but...
So theoretically, you could do all of this with that other piece of kit you're talking about.
Well, I think the thing is, this is the piece of kit for the guy whose job it is being video split, right?
Yeah.
Of which there are people like, you know, Swan here, like whose just job it is to be video split, and they work regularly doing that, and they're really bloody good at it.
Yeah.
If your job isn't to do that full-time, and then you're trying to put your own system together, then I think you could probably get Conduit Live with FCP would get you a system that does most of this without the ease of having it in one package. And also you'd need to be, you know, I don't know, tech savvy to be able to set it up.
Yeah, because you were, so it sounds like you were Video Village as well, you poor bastard.
On my complex effect shots, because I wouldn't
get it right. Absolutely, you've got to get it right. That is the other thing, obviously. Yeah, if you want to do lay up sort of complex shots and make sure your green screen, you make sure your background you're matting in is the foreground plates is lining up.
For the actors, I've got to tell you, like for the actors to have some confidence, they're not going to look like complete burks when walking around on a green screen. I think it's vital to be able to show them some shots.
This is what you're going to look like.
Yeah, you are looking out here from the side of a spaceship at a nebula, and it looks kind of like this. And
yeah.
They go, oh, that looks cool.
So they can do a take hanging in front of a green screen on
and
wires
not, like,
or whatever,
feel
reacting
like
something
just
amazing.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, so you can sort of shoot that, then come and have a look at the go, oh, I see, that's what I'm going to look like.
I mean, really, keeping the confidence of the actors is a pretty key thing, especially when they're like, you know, major comic actors who are having to, quite frankly, you know, stick their neck out career-wise and do some pretty wacky stuff.
Yeah.
They're going to want to know that it's, they're not, I mean, they obviously weren't. They were completely covered, supported and looked after, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, more and more.
It's an act of faith.
There is no, you know, air conditioning hose like Abyss to sort of react to. There's not really all that on-set stuff to react to. It's usually like dinosaur head on a 20-foot pit of 2x1, you know, react to this.
And or yet, what sells that green effect cross. Shot is how good the actor is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
Like the irony is that the actor's just acting to a piece of polystyrene and could easily look a bit like
that's what makes the shot.
But if they commit
die.
To the shot 100% and, as you said, that's what sells the show, that's what makes it work.
So yes, it's definitely worthwhile to, if you're doing green screen stuff, to have some bit of kit like this, or to be able to basically let the actors see what they're going to be reacting to, even if it's just for one take on Video Village and then go back into it. But it's good to have that feedback. I see. The nebula's that big.
Yeah, I was doing quite a bit of... I mean, when we're under the crunch, I was like, see that marker up there?
Yeah.
Okay, that's where a really big vortex is happening.
That so three-inch cross of green tape
that's
on green...
That's a nuclear explosion.
That is a 50 trillion kiloton nuclear explosion coming to you at fast the speed of light.
Yes.
Okay?
Now,
action.
Now be funny. That's it for this week for Red Center. Again, just love having you guys connect up with us and talk to us through the Twitters and through the net, so please keep doing that.
Absolutely.
Next week,
a lot of
big
the features, a lot of the people that we've spoken to, a lot of the interview subjects, like Rodney Charters that I spoke to on a couple of episodes back, which was equally, people loved hearing from him. That was, a brilliant Twitter suggestion from Tyler Ginter. Thank you very much. So a lot of this stuff, a lot of the suggestions of gear that we look at is all, we've all got extra, we've got lives to get on with as well. So it's fantastic for you guys feeding us back. Hey, have you seen this clip? Have you seen this guy's interview? Have you seen this bit of gear? So, absolutely. We say it all the time, but, it does actually help build the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, in
we
a very
can't
real
be
sense.
Web omnipresent.
No. We rely on you guys. Hey, thanks again. We're going to have a huge show next week because, of course, we'll have the Goss from Vegas.
Yes, indeed.
And hopefully it'll be good Goss. And
hopefully
it'll be good, Goss. We have people on the ground that are, getting into all the right parties and bribing all the right people. So.
Bastards.
Until next time, and I hopefully have got my voice back. I'm Mike Seymour. I'm available on FX Guide or FX PhD, as I've probably mentioned more this week than any other week.
Yes, your Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Seymour. I'm twitter.com/Wingrove. Or jasonwingrove.com, or we're both also occasionally on VFX Show, which is, what's the URL or link for that?
Well, it's in iTunes, but also there's just vfxshow.com.
Right, yeah.
Which we own.
Yes, indeed. And that's about it. Or, and as I say, any feedback, that is red@fxguide.com, feedback for Red Centre. We appreciate it.
Okay, until next week when we have the big goss from the big show. Talk to you later. See you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.